So the person with the active knowledge is a true idiot. And he doesn't mind admitting it. You see, so in public, if somebody said, I remember you should be very happy with this thing, we are not in public at the moment. Public is public. The pubis is the centre of sexual drive. And the public is so called because they act from that centre and from nowhere else. And people is the same concept. So, those who bend the knee under stimulus, those who can be forced to the ground by saying, and if you don't do as I tell you, there'll be none of that. You see? Or if you do do as I tell you, there'll be a lot of that. Forward, lads, over the ramparts. And they go. Now, those are called the public, or pubic determined beings. So that when, in the Bible, it is said of God, he says, my dearly beloved public. You see? He says, my dear turtle doves. But the word turtle is tour. It means those touring in the groove. And they're keeping his universe going for him. And they don't know why. There's an impulse in them that makes them reproduce, makes them go on in the same old groove. Therefore it says, many are called to freedom, few are chosen. Because not everybody could be free, because if everybody were free, there'd be no universe. So the masses have to be kept keeping the big wheels turning, and a few can get out.
That applies to Lucifer.
Oh, yes. Lucifer is a man who generated the gross material world as a device.
So that the world is like a treadmill,
isn't it? As was called, the mills of God grinding slowly, don't they? It is a treadmill. There's not a religion in the world that doesn't say so. There's not a philosophy in the world that doesn't say that the material world is a treadmill. And they're all trying to get out of it. But there's only one way out. That's being an idiot. That is to say, you have to contradict everything that people call value, only you mustn't let the public know. Otherwise they'll kick you. Because they would like a bit of it too. And they're quite sure you're unreliable if you're free. Because you know there's no way of predicting what a free person will do. Supposing you were an employer of labour, and you wanted a certain output, would you say to your men, now men, I believe in freedom and democracy, and every man must make his own decisions, so if I see you on Monday morning, I'll be surprised. You see? It wouldn't do, would it?
No.
So what you have is a system of ideas which you feed at them through special terms, and you say, men, there's a rival firm down the road, and they say very slighting things about the people that work here, and the only thing to do is to show them that have more fibre than they have. Pull together, fellows. You see, and then they go and pull together. Now, it's all legitimate. It's very important to realise that you should not shed tears for the public over such things. Because if you go to the dear public, as they're about to go into the football ground, and say, public, stop. You're in bondage. Do you realise that you're going to a football match because it happens to be a sexual symbol? Stop. Consider. Don't go. Turn back. You see, well, after they'd picked up a flat piece of paper, say like a man, you see, you'd be able to think about it, wouldn't you? You've got to be realistic. There's something can be done, but not with the public as such. You cannot do anything at all with a mass of people. You can only do something with yourself. And what you can do with yourself, C-O-O-F, because the self, that letter C is the same as letter. The self is simply a cell with a spirit in it. The F at the end means the spirit. So a self is a spirit inside a little house, its own cell. That you can work on. You can never work on anybody else. You can fire stimuli out by speaking and rattle the atmosphere with it, but there's a medium between your vocal apparatus and that person's ear. You can rattle the air, and the air may rattle the eardrum, and the eardrum may rattle a centre in the brain, but if there's nobody there, nothing's going to happen. So you have to realise that you can only work on yourself, and get rid of all that pseudo-compassion that wants to work on football crowds.
returning to the return to the fool, does he never fall over that cliff because he was a present?
Now, the pool, that cliff represents the edge of now.
It's always now.
It's always now. As you walk forward, that thing is just ahead of you. You see? You know, there was a great skeptic in Greece. Actually, his Peg's favourite. A fellow called Pyrrho. And Pyrrho said, "I don't believe anything. I'm really going to go the whole hog on this. So I'm not going to believe anything I see or hear at all." And he went down the road, followed by his disciples, and a great big cart came at him, and he didn't get out of the way. So one of his disciples grabbed hold of him, pulled him out of the way, whereupon he promptly flogged him and said, "What do you mean by believing that phenomenal thing to be real?" You see, while he was doing this, he fell in the ditch. So another disciple dragged him out, so he flogged him and said, "What made you think I was in the ditch?" Now, he was really whole hoggy. And the funny thing was, it couldn't happen to anybody but such a man that such disciples would pull him out. You see, he didn't perish, you know. He attracted more and more disciples. Because he was a whole hogger, and he was determined to find out. And he discovered a very peculiar thing. That there is something orderly existing, whether we believe it or not. You see? Something exists. Now, Kant made a very silly statement. You'd expect a man called Kant to make a silly statement. He made one. He said, "There's no order in the world other than that imposed on it by the human mind." You see? And the opposite idea, just as silly, is there is only order in the world and there's none in the human mind. Whereas actually, what we call order is a reciprocal relation between this and this. There's energy outside, and there's energy inside, separated by that membrane, the cell membrane. Changes of motion there induce changes of motion in here, according to a very definite pattern. And there's a real orderly relation between the two, expressible geometrically, mathematically, rationally, psychologically, and so on. And it really exists. We don't impose it. If we come running in this room full of faith, in the dark, will fall all over the chairs. They exist. So it's not merely subjective, and it's not entirely objective as if it could exist without an observer. The observer is present, and the fact is present. So in pursuing, like Pyrrho did, or like Thomas did, sticking his finger in, the idea, if you can really tell yourself that precipice represents the edge of now, and it's forever moving ahead of you, so you needn't worry. If you start worrying about what's over there, you're thinking about tomorrow, and you're not a proper fool. You're a rationalist and a considerer, and on the way to becoming a nervous dyspeptic. Because all consideration of anything over that edge is a worry process about your security. And it has to be stopped. And the funny thing is that when people stop it, their inner condition is totally different. And yet you cannot guess what that condition would be like from empirical processes before. Because really, you come to a point where you don't care if there is a real edge there. Because you know there isn't. And your eyes still function and they can see the furniture as usual. Ears still listen to motor horns and send messages and you get out of the way and so on. Everything functions in an orderly manner as it should do. So you're not accident prone, and nevertheless you're not worried about tomorrow.
Is there any way in which you can keep yourself in now?
All right. Pardon?
Is there any way in which you can keep yourself from going forward and back all the time as you meet situations? For instance, if something happens to you, you almost automatically start thinking about what that's liable to cause in the future or how such a thing was dealt with in the past.
Mm.
You're constantly fluctuating backwards and forwards.
Yes, but
is there any way of holding yourself?
Now, it's very important to realise that what you've just said is true. Mechanically, that occurs.
Yes.
It's only mechanics. It's nothing at all to do with what you call I. Remember this, if you can see a thing, it is not the seer. The seer is a catalyst. He doesn't do anything. But when he becomes conscious, of what is going on, the thing changes. Consciousness changes events. But most people are quite unconscious of what's going on. And in the case of a worry, it is actually true to say that children are taught to worry by their parents. They don't worry naturally. A child that has not had an accident and not had any education doesn't worry about tomorrow. Neither can it remember its past. It's too busy enjoying itself now. But worry is taught to children and becomes a complex of ideas in the mind functioning mechanically and saying the same old, oh, do be careful, watch that, consider this, what will so-and-so say? And if you listen to your own mind, this is the how of it, first you must listen and just don't try to stop it. See if you can recognize the voice that you hear and who said it first. Because it's all recorded in the original voices of the people who said it to you. So you'll find Aunt Matilda saying, oh, do be careful there. There's a very deep edging, I'm sure it's 3 inches high. And you recognize her voice. And you gradually thus extricate your eye, your observer, which is your real self, from identification with the voices. Because all those different statements are made by different people in the past. You know that they must be, because they're in English in this case, aren't they? And therefore, to extricate yourself, first of all, you don't try to interfere. If you interfere prematurely, you will not get the results. First you must watch. This is called watching the monkey jump. The mind is a monkey, you see. It's always working. Just watch it. And you'll find it's full of tricks. It copies everything. So it says one thing like Aunt Matilda and another thing like Uncle Sammy. And it says them running one after the other. Now actually you can sometimes hear in somebody's voice different ways of pronouncing the same word in different sentences. Because they were learned from different aunts who've come from different parts of the country. And they're coming out more or less as they were put in. So all your first practice is not to try to interfere, because if you interfere prematurely, you will not know what was there. Whereas, if you are prepared to watch and not make any moral judgment about it, just watch it, you'll find there's a lot of people talking rubbish in your memory. And you can hear arguments going on in totally different voices, recommending this and contradicting the same thing. And then you will discover the meaning of their name is Legion. There are myriads of beings inside you recording, and none of them the observer. All you have to do is just say, there is such a voice saying such a thing. Never say, I am thinking. That is untrue. There is thinking proceeding, but not I am thinking. I does not think. I watches. Thinking is presentation of ideas. When you hear a voice saying, do be careful, there's a bucket near the bottom of the stairs, you see, then it belongs to the person who said it, and it's recorded in your memory. But if you identify with it, you're likely to trip over where the bucket would have been if it had been. You see the principle of it? That's quite a simple principle. Never allow yourself to identify. Identification, you know, the dent in identity means tooth. It's a cogwheel, you see. You put, there's an idea, and you put yourself in mess with it, so if one turns, the other has to turn. So identification is the same thing as bondage, slavery. So when you say I, always try to feel what is watching. I'm the watcher. But I'm not a thing, I'm not a thinker. If there is an emotion, it is not I feeling. There is feeling in the I. There is thinking in the eye. There is an argument in the eye. But do not identify with it. Identify means I've got teeth, which is untrue. Those teeth are the separate ideas. On one side of a saw you've got teeth. You can count those. On the other side you've got a long smooth line, a continuum, which you cannot count. So the identity is a counting process. And it's wrong. And you can never say that the whole steel of that is a tooth. That's only a wave on its edge.
Another question I'd like to ask you, in that threefold diagram there of the religion, the science and the philosophy, without the link you must have constant conflict going on there as you're getting stimulus, because each must react in a different way, isn't it?
Oh yes, and remember this, that the man that taught you mathematics was generally a specialist, wasn't he? So he wasn't a religious man or a philosophical man. And the man that's trying to get you into church isn't generally interested in mathematics. And the philosopher isn't interested in the religious side at all, and in the mathematical one only as a means to philosophy.
It's like three separate poles.
Well, you've got three voices, three sources, quite different, who, if you put them together in a room in real life, would fight violently about the principle of the universe. So their ideas fed into you, fight violently new. So unless you get that witch's sieve and insert it and make sure that whatever comes through changes its form to fit the terms of the new department, when you do that, then you will get these link factors and discover that every emotion is no more than a certain amount of energy inside a sensorium, a substance which is sentient. That substance is able to assimilate a certain amount of energy. When it's assimilating it easily, it is called pleasure. When the entrance of energy becomes faster than can be assimilated, it is called pain, and the thing begins to move away. If the inflow of energy is slightly less and could be assimilated, it moves towards it to increase the rate of stimulation. So the more you think about those three and find the link factors, the less conflict there will be inside you, and also the more possible it will be for you to resolve the differences of opinion between those three people who taught you those things when you meet them. Well, let's take that sentence. Who is actually speaking when you analyze a situation? Now, who is actually speaking is already something that you've been trained to say. Something put into your ear, isn't it? When you analyze, it's another series of words, you see, and in that situation is another series of words. All have gone into your ear and have been engraved on your mind, and it happens that something has occurred in this conversation that has gone in at the ear and fitted in, say on the word analysis, and vibrated them all and stepped up their intensity so that they've entered consciousness, they've gone through the threshold from the unconscious where they were stored into consciousness because the eardrum was rattled. So when you say who, you see, it's a misunderstood question. Who is the observer? He never does anything. The thing is, when you identify with the observer, with the consciousness, and then look at the situation with that back movement so that you know, the situation alters spontaneously. You know, in chemistry, the little substances called catalysts. Those substances don't do anything themselves, but if you put them near two others, the other two do something. And consciousness is just like that. So if you think about that question again, you immediately discover but it doesn't mean what it appeared to me. What is called the solution of the problem is an enumeration of the parts and their relations. So there aren't any problems other than formal situations. And those formal situations have words to cover them. So in your mind, a formal problem is the relation and the significances of the terms. What does the word mean? That cat has nine tails. What kind of a cat is it? It's one of those that they flog prisoners with in jail. The word cat now has a different meaning because we've changed the context. I'm mentioning the word jail and flogging prisoners. Then the word cat is no longer an animal but a kind of whip. so that we are changing the significance of terms by changing the constellation of other terms around them. And the more we juggle with the terms and watch the effect on our idea system, thinker, our feeling system, whether we like it or dislike it when the change occurs, and our urge tendency, whether we tend to do something about it or not. Because some people, like one fellow I knew, who were discussing a certain thing and he said, if that's true, we can pick the winners out immediately. And from that moment, his mind was closed to anything from outside and running down like this was a speculation about how to pick winners. And he was then unfit to discuss anything else because a certain amount of energy had been fed into the idea of winning, and he tried on other occasions and failed. There was an energy inhibited from the failure, and here was a promise which stimulated. And then, a fortnight later, he came back and he said, that system works. You see? Now, of course, that system, as he'd seen it, he'd fed certain things in, he'd worked in a certain way, it's a very high intensity, and certain things had come up. He then began to relax. My future is assured. You see? He had under his arm a book with photographs of all the race horses in it. I think Ken knows who it is. And his future was assured, you see. And then he tried to apply this principle on the whole book of horses. And the next week he came back and he said, it's very complicated. You see? The fact was that he thought he'd make a free decision to protect himself from future worries. He wasn't being a fool then, he was thinking about the future. You see? And that cannot be done. Because the whole world is full of pseudo-fools, the people rushing madly along, and a very, very few really silly people directing them in which direction they should rush, which they do by giving them verbal stimulation periodically. So the important thing is to realize that what you call thinking isn't anything other than repetition of fed-in data, which data fit in a certain way habitually, and that way is the wrong way. So that you have to get the data that are fed in and alter them. See, when Lewis Carroll, who was a logician and a theologian and a Hebrew scholar and a mathematician, wrote the Alice books, what he was doing it for was not to amuse the children, but to release himself from certain concepts from tradition. So he inverted everything. He cut words in half and joined the two together. So he made words like slithy, out of lithe and slimy. He called them portmanteau words. And then he did special logical exercises which invert the natural order of events, so-called, which isn't natural at all. It is only social and moral. And so he released energy in his mind. When he wrote the story of Alice, Alice means the soul. When Alice is going on the chessboard to get to the eighth rank means eternal existence, immortality. And she has to move in a certain order on the board to queen. That is, the soul, to get the rulership, the dominion, has to move in a certain order on the chessboard, which is black and white. You see, I don't like it, I do like it. All through the board until perfection is attained. And if you read that story intelligently, you'll discover it is really a key to the evolution of the soul in disguise. The whole relativity of time is the relativity of space is discussed in it. The theory of the races of the earth is discussed in it. In one place she cries, doesn't she, because she made a big attempt to get through a little door, and she's got a key on a table and she can't reach it, and so on. This table is like the table of the law, which she's got the key in it, but she's been going up and down and she's never the right size. She's either too big to get through the door, which means egotism, or too small to reach the law, which is up there. So she cries and makes a big pool of tears. And that means the plasticity of life. Water means material as plastic possibility. Every situation is a plastic possibility for the person who knows. You can model the situation. She cries very bitterly and then everybody gets wet and there's all sorts of animals there. Those are the subsidiary impulses. And then they have to get dry again. And so there is invented a Caucasus race which they have to run. And it is a reference to the Caucasian people, who are the driest people in the world. That is to say, the white Caucasians, you know that the European people came out of the Caucasus, and they're called the Caucasus race, or Caucasians, and they're the men that made the causes of events. They push things. They don't wait. The Negroes move backwards towards sensual pleasure. You see, the Indians moved backwards to absorption in the infinite. The Caucasians move forward into the situation and hammer it very, very hard. So they're called the dry race. And Heraclitus, talking about human beings, and there are two kind of men, wet men and dry men. And dry men are better than wet men. And he said the proof is very simple. A wet man, like a drunkard, can't walk straight. Wet means sentimentally sloppy. And dry means intellectual. So the man who uses his analytical self is drying up his sentimental slushiness. And Carroll was thoroughly aware of this evolutionary necessity, and he wrote it in the form of an apparent fairy story. But that book is read by all the mathematicians and logicians of the world, and by all the great militarists and philosophers. The babies can't understand what it's about. And they must know, why do the intelligentsia of the world have the Alice stories on their shelf? Why do they read them, and why do they quote them? Why is it the great logician suddenly saying, curiouser and curiouser, as Alice said? You see? Yet, an elementary bit of logic. Logic of Aristotle is based on what is called a syllogism, where the same word is literally meant. It's really a disguised repetition by changing the term. You see, that's if you say, men, Aristotle said, men are featherless bipeds. They're beings with two legs with no feathers on. You see, if you ask what featherless bipeds are, he says men. That's a very short tautology, it goes back. On one occasion, the caterpillar was sitting on a mushroom, and Alice came along, and she got the wrong size again. She was either being egotistically big, or she was being too humble so she couldn't aspire. Because those are the two ways people go. As I'm bigger than you, and I'm no good at all. And I can never be just right, you see. So, one of these sides of the mushroom, if she eats it, will make it grow big, and the other one will make it grow small. So she says to the caterpillar, because she wants to change size, which one will help me to grow smaller? And he looked at her and said, the small-making side, of course. Now that was Carroll poking fun at logic. And it only says the same thing that you've just said in a disguised way. And people go away thinking they've got the reply to the question. And you haven't given them one. All you've done is extend the definition. We had a bit of fun on Tuesday. We went to a birthday party with a certain lady. Yeah. And she's what we might call a feminine woman in the full sense. And it says she cannot understand anything you say to her if it's common sense. But you have to emote. And she was doing some puppets, you see. And there were three of us there, and we know her very, very well. It was her birthday party. And she said, what kind of puppets would you make if you wanted to make quite sure that a fairly large audience would be able to see them? So we all looked very learned, and we said, one's about that big. And she said, thank you very much. She said, I've been worrying about that. And Philip said, and it's a very good idea, he said, to, if you want to catch the eye, to put bright colours on them. She said, yes, I'll do that. And I said, and furthermore, unless you want the feet to bounce too much, make the feet heavy enough so that they stay down instead of coming up. And she said, yes, how would you do that? And I said, well, weight them a bit. She said, I never thought of that. This went on for about 2 hours about her puppets. And all it was a simple statement on what the situation exactly required. And she can't say that for herself. But she can get all the puppets and put them in her arms. And that was how made lovely. She gave us a performance of Chinese dance, an Indian dance, a Swiss one, a Dutch one, a Javanese one, a South American one, and they were all beautifully dressed, these dolls. And she brought them on the stage, a little stage lit. Brought them on the stage, and they all came on, showing their right side, and they didn't turn round, and they all lift their right leg up like that. And at the end, they did a bow and went on. And she said, "How was it?" And we said, "For a Chinese doll, it would be a good idea to get a Chinese dance, especially like they do." And she said, "Yes, I must do that." You see? And this was helping her, because she couldn't say that to me. And she's now determined that Hungarian one is going to do a Hungarian dance. He's not just lifted his right leg up. And altogether, you know, unless you've seen him, because she's a very, very affectionate woman. She emotes all the time. She's fond of anybody and everything. The valley accidentally stand on a call. But at the same time, she's quite incapable of analysing the most elementary things. And therefore, she wants help. Now, everything that's gone into your mind may or may not be true. And you should suspect what's in that box. Masonically, this is called the ivory box, the skull. Christ was crucified in Golgotha, the place of the skull, wasn't it? It's a symbolic reference to this. This is called the temple, isn't it? The temple of God is with man, this is it, in the ivory box. Is the Solomonic seal of the King of Peace, where if you sort out what is in the box and get it in its proper positions, then you will be efficient in whatever you do. But you must never think that because it's in your head that it's necessarily true, just because it's been done on you by education, you see. The thing that stops people developing is the real belief that it can't be really fundamentally false if I've been. So never identify with any mental content, and then you won't want to defend it. Say that it's an idea, not that it's mine. Obviously, it's quite wrong to say an idea is mine. If you can explain it to somebody else, they must have it. That must be shared.
No.
No, of course not. That's a blast. It can get a little more. To get out of the groove.
Yes, to start accepting. Say you started to accept his rules. You might be unhappy for the rest of your life.
You mean not going to football match?
No, not necessarily that. Anything that you can accept, say, accept the fact that I did a football match. And he knows that he has committed, say, a certain wrong. And to put it right, he would say he would have to stay in the one place. But he knows that if he stays in that one place, he's going to be unhappy. So he just wanders up.
Well, you see, he's not fulfilling any of the conditions in the just outline. He's considering the whole of his future existence to begin with. And he's postulating that there is a situation which, if he stays in, he must be unhappy in the future.
Yes.
Well, all that is the very kind of work that we're supposed to be stopping. You see, you're defining that isn't the end of the cliff, but there's a lot of land on there with tribulations on it that you're going to walk on. Aren't you? You define the situation which, if you stay in it, maybe in the future, you're going to be unhappy. That's a speculation about your future. That's not being a fool at all. That's being in the groove. That's all your traditional, all your educational determinants are recommending to you, that you should be careful about what you do. That's the thing that's got to be stopped.
What I've already done, you mean? Or what?
what has been done and the speculations derived from it of what might be done, they've got to be stopped. You've got to put your, for instance, I said a little earlier, first of all, you must watch in your mind and see if you can recognize the voices, the statements that were made. See if you can recognize the sources. Because when you begin to see the sources, you'll think, good gracious, I'm not having Antichrist talking to me like that. You see, you become identified with it. So you defend it, because you think it's yours. And it isn't. Can you understand that? But your memory, all the words that you hear when you're doing what you think is thinking, it's machinery. You must stop it. Stop that speculation.
Of being checking the confusion.
That's right. Just watch what is going on in your mind now. Know that it's from the past, because the future's not here yet. And know that if you watch it very carefully, it cannot affect you in the future. But if you don't, it will. Consciousness is a catalyst. That is, if you become aware of what is inside your mind, it will change. It can't push you about. You know what it is. It can only push you about if it's in the dark.
I'm still frightened of it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Actually, there's evidence in certain muscle tensions across there on you of a certain background fear. Now, you can't see that, because if you look in the mirror, you see your face as you've always seen it. Constant stimulation is no stimulation. But it isn't the normal, it isn't the right thing for you. And if you stop that fear of the future, which is conditioned by the past, by looking at the present only, then it will alter completely. You mustn't be afraid of anything whatever in the future. You mustn't imagine that if you were confined to a house with a certain person, that you would necessarily be unhappy. All that projection into the future. That's creation of a destiny that you don't want.
I couldn't make the statement on that I know I would feel happy.
No, you couldn't, could you? Not truthfully. You don't even know how long you're going to live, or how long that fellow's going to live, or how long whatever it is going to be there. You've no idea. The whole thing might be wiped out like that in half an hour. There's a crash. An airplane near Bolton, wasn't there? Lots of Manx people were killed in Mary Summers. They're all speculating on tomorrow. The same with Manchester United. You don't know. That's why you've got to live as if the next second afterwards will be your last. So take care of this one. Get yourself right now. It's not morbidity. It's pure reason to handle your present moment properly. Maybe you are. And to be deprived of your body suddenly is to be deprived of the means of your future education in that travelling now. So use it when you've got it, which is now. So don't allow yourself to consider a fear. When one appears in your mind, which it will mechanically, don't consider it, but look at it and say, who said that? Can you do that now? Look in your mind and listen. And ask yourself, who said that first? And see if you can recognize the tone of the voice. Is it yours or somebody else's? Can you hear anything going on in your mind?
the moment now.
So why do you think that is? Do you usually do?
Yes.
Well, why do you think that you can't at the moment?
Something on my attention centered here.
Well, now, you've seen something there, haven't you? But a certain kind of worry process, which would go on very, very often, has been stopped at this moment, hasn't it?
Yes.
By attending to a subject. And when you start looking for it, you're not afraid of it, are you? You're not running away from it, you're running towards it. And its power to come up is stolen off it if you're prepared to look at it.
But at this moment now, I can accept any situation.
At this moment?
Yeah.
But you're only in this situation now. You can't accept any situation other than the fact that you're sitting on that sitting.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But as soon as I walk away from here, I know that...
No, you don't. You're talking about your memory of past events. You're already allowing your past to project your future. You're saying that whatever's happened in the past is going to repeat in the future. Aren't you? Can you see the logic of that?
Yes.
And can you see that it's fundamentally wrong for a free being to do it?
But I can't see any real change.
How can you see a real change in the future when you're looking into the past? What you're looking at is your memory. You're indulging in a statistical speculation. Aren't you? Nothing else. Can't be anything else. You're looking backwards and designing your future and ignoring your present. Can you see that it's utterly illogical and can't possibly make for freedom to allow the past to project your future and then condition your behavior for you on the basis of it? What you have to do is put yourself now where you are, look in your mind and see what you can see now. See what comes up and see if you can recognize who said it. Who taught you that? Where did you get it from? You often hear people say at the end of a long logical demonstration, which has been quite valid, "Oh yes, but." That's a very common sign of words. "Oh yes, but." Isn't it? Where did they get it from? They heard it from long ago. Nearly everybody says at the end of the proof that they're wrong, "Oh yes, but." Don't they? You can hear it in every discussion on the radio or the TV. You hear it all over the country, all over the world. "Oh yes, but." Because I'm not going to be proved wrong, whatever you say. So if you're absolutely logical, "Oh yes, but." The "but" means there's more to be said.
Somewhere.
Somewhere. "Oh yes, but." So there's a tendency, and it's nothing to do with you as an observer. It's to do with the way you've been conditioned, trained. And it's rolling along, and if you don't stop it, it'll write your future for you.
That's inertia.
That's inertia, yes. The only way you can stop it is by looking at it. Mm-hmm. Straight in the face, and it alters. Because it doesn't like being looked at. You see, there was a second reason why you couldn't find those things. They happen to be psychic tendencies. They don't want you to look at them. Because if you do, you'll kill them. You'll kill them stone dead if you get a straight look at them. And they're defences of those very beings. Supposing you were told when you were about 3 not to muck about like that on the carpet or something by your Auntie Rosie. See? And it's there in your mind. Well, there's an emotion with it, isn't there? The emotion that says, if I don't do that, then I'll be slapped. So later on, in another situation, there arises in your mind a fear that you'll be hit, damaged, injured, somehow, in an undefined way, if you start mucking about. You see that? You've got an emotional thing there, and it's only a record in your memory. And if you're not careful, it will write your future for you. Insurance companies can write the future of most people.
So I'll just forget what the Andy said and just carry on looking at us.
No. That's again a projection into the future. You've got to watch, knowing that if you watch, the situation will change. As you see that it was only Auntie Rose saying so and so, or only Uncle Bill doing so and so. As you become aware of that, the awareness changes it. It can't bind you anymore. Suppose a guy threatened you with a dagger, you see, and you go like that, and as you go like that, I just have my finger on the point and bend it. It's only a rubber one. Then you relax, don't you? The consciousness, the awareness of what it is, changes it. So don't you try to do anything with them, except become aware of them. It's tremendously important not to do anything with them at first, just to see what they are and see if you can recognize who said it. Where was it? Remember that mental inertia will try to persuade you not to do it. And it's the past thought process will go on and produce arguments saying, oh, well, never you mind about conversation in the present. You'll still be here tomorrow, which is future. You see? That's mass inertia of your past ideas pushing aside the very thing that can save you.
A real difference between this school and a sort of simple, primitive people who are irresponsible.
Oh yes, very real. This fool is intensely active intellectual. He's an intensely active intellectual, not an intellectualist. He's concerned only with knowing things without being able to do things. He's determined to apply the logic of the universe in act in his own life, consciously, deliberately, rationally. Now most primitive people don't. They just move along the feeling line. The dead, that is people in the routine. So the fool is the quick fellow. You see, the title of Mercury, who is the Messiah of the Romans, is quick for silver. He's quick, he can assume any form.
Yeah, there's a very big difficulty with me that I'm really not sick. I have no fear of tomorrow. It's a fear for people who live like that. It's a consequence.
Without wanting to. Obviously, those people are not actually living like that at all. They're just gripped by immediate sensations. They're subjected to a sensual stimulus of pleasure, you see, or avoidance of pain, immediately. We actually find people that are so easily stimulated that you can go and interrupt whatever they're doing by giving them a drink of this or a bite of that, don't we? And they immediately stop what they're doing and forget all about it. That's not a fool. That's a dead man in the groove. The conscious fool is exactly the opposite of that. You can't divert him. If you try to divert him, he thinks, what kind of a diversion is this? What is this? What is this fellow up to? He doesn't say so to the fellow who's diverting him. And he says immediately, now, I wonder if the thing he's diverting me to has experiential value. But if it has, I'll go with him. And he will think I'm going with him for his reason. But really, I'm going with him for my reason. And so apparently he gets led into the situation. But his eyes are open. He sees the situation. Yes, thank you very much.
What puzzles me about all this? What's the dynamic force that will change one within the other into being a fool?
Consciousness. Nothing else can do
it. So it's quite possible for anyone to.
It is possible for everybody to do it. It is extremely unlikely that anybody will try except a little handful because of the strength of the external stimulus. You see, now suppose we raid one of the local pubs and we select at random any fellow and take him outside and say, are you a member of the mob? You say, certainly not. So what are you doing with those fellows in there? Aren't they members of the mob? I said, well, they are a bit, but I only go in there because I have nowhere else to go tonight. Well, did you go there other night? Otherwise, I have nowhere else to go. So you're not really a mass man. You're not a member of a mob, are you? Oh, no, I don't agree with mob psychology. Well, how often do you go in there? Oh, every night. Didn't you say that you went there only when you had nowhere else to go? Oh, yes, but that's every night. You take any individual out, no matter how big the crowd is, select at random, you get a mass of people rushing off to make a protest. And you stop one, get hold of them and say, why are you walking with this mass of uncontrolled people? And he goes. And he immediately thinks, I'm really dignified, I don't do this sort of thing. And he says, come on, it's not for you, is it? And he says, no. And he looks around to see if any of his friends have seen him desert. And if they haven't, he goes with you. Because he knows to be an integrated individual is higher than to be just a bit of sludge flowing with a lot of other sludge. So he's really ashamed of what he's doing underneath. It's just that he can't see the way out. And he cannot be taught the way out in the mass. He can only be taught it individually. And the mass, as such, is not going to be taught because they provide the children for the next generation to keep the mills going. There's a special conspiracy of silence. In masonry, it says, mum's the word. You see, mum's the word, isn't it? It's tremendously important to realize that you cannot tell all those people because they already know that what they're doing doesn't move towards freedom. But the lush sentimentality and the sensual delight carry them because the universal force is driving them. Sexuality is an individual force, it's a universal force. Sentimentality is a universal force. And it forces the millions in a definite direction, but it wants some to get out to direct them. So it's possible to get out with universal help for the few, but not for the many.
Election.
Yeah, that's the meaning of the election of grace. Yeah. Now the people don't normally think about it. And if you get a parson who thinks about it and then wonders whether he's one of the elect, he will write an essay to prove that the election of grace is rubbish. See? It's always biased reason. So the Calvinists talk about only a certain number are destined for salvation, you know. And the rest are wasting their time trying. To which the others say, if they've read the book, what wicked people the Calvinists are. You see, but the Calvinists have got hold of a symbolic statement, and it happens to be true, that a definite number of bricks in a pyramid, so many at the bottom, so many on the next layer, fewer still, near the top, a few, and on the very top, none. The invisible spirit brick. You see? Now, it's true that there's only a few top places in a pyramid, in a social pyramid, in a political pyramid, in a scientific pyramid. There's only a few. And nevertheless, everybody is free to try to get one. But those who like sludging about at the bottom won't try. But they'll look up every now and then at somebody who's gone and say, ambitious so-and-so, I remember him when he was such and such. You see, they're no better than the one that climbed. But they like to think so. They say, well, we weren't ambitious. We were cruel. We didn't tread on everybody. But if you listen to the conversation of the average employee in a big work, you'll find that a large amount of their energy is spent tearing the bosses to bits. Not because the bosses are no good, they're no worse than the workers, but because they're not quite so restricted by financial problems. That's why sentimentality has no place in the kind of work that you've got to do on yourself.
There's only a universal force then, designed to make sure that people continue to behave as they do, to keep those mills grinding.
Oh, yes. And yet a definite number of them can get out. Which particular ones constitute that definite number is not determined. That depends on which ones want to try.
Entirely up to yourself.
Entirely up to yourself.
Who determines that?
Well, it's called an election of grace, isn't it? That is to say that those who've already done it can look at somebody and say, he's a likely man for the job. He's still free, you can say, well, I don't want the job.
Someone who said the other night about the difference between American and Englishman. In America, every man thinks he has a chance of being a president.
Hmm.
But not every man tries, of course. But in England, nobody thinks he can be king.
Hmm. We had that last time, didn't we, in Manchester?
Was it you that said that? I thought I heard it a little
Well, that is a fact, isn't it? That any man thinks he's potentially a president in America.
Yeah.
But really, unless he belongs in a certain family and has a certain money, or has the gift of the gab, he will never be put forward. But even theoretically in England, you're not able to become the king unless you have a revolution. Which you can't have without their help. Because they're at the top. Like the one of Cromwell, you see. That the Cromwellian revolution was arranged from the top. Actually, Cromwell and his cousin used to confer during the battles at Oxford, and the cousin was on the other side. You see? And the reason was this: it is necessary at certain at certain periods for every idea to fail because of the wave progression of the universe. So the concept of royalty has to fail periodically. Because people become dissatisfied and they always look up to the top and say, we know the cause of our troubles. It's that fellow at the top, the king, you see. And this accumulates until finally a king has to be deposed or decapitated or beheaded. When they say beheaded, they do not mean sawing this off, really. They mean that they print a picture of him having his head cut off and circulate it, and he retires.
Within such a position, the king is aware that he is king.
Oh, yes. Except his sacrifice consists in going into hiding. In the case of Charles I, he changed his name and went to Oxford, where he carried on his alchemical studies under another name. And there is a portrait of him there under another name, which is quite obvious for him, namely Elias Ashmole. No, you know that little saying that Charles I walked and talked for so long after his head was off. Hmm? You've heard that tradition.
Yes.
Well, it's that little joke that the aristocracy made. He wasn't really killed at all. They printed a picture of him, you see, in which he's represented as being prepared for beheading. And in these days, they'd cook a photograph if they wanted to. Then they got a court painter to do it. And the scribe who is making the record in the painting is writing it with his left hand. Which means this didn't really happen in old England. It's just an idea. Ideas and actions. So what happened was this. You see, Charles I wanted to get America colonized. And he didn't want to fill it full of rabble. He wanted some intelligent men to go out to administrate as well. And the intelligent men wouldn't go. They said it's a horrible place over there. So he said to get them over there, all right, I will govern without a parliament. So they said, well, if you do that, we'll leave. He said, thank you very much. Now, this bred a bad feeling, you see, necessitated him being beheaded, or changing his name and hiding. And then, they put the power man, Cromwell, you see, in to hammer the people like a dictator. And then, immediately after him, they put his son, who was a weakling, on the throne. And straight away, there was the Restoration. And the problem of royalty was established for a long period then. There's no more kick then until our present Charles gets on the throne. We've got a Charlie coming up now. This Charlie's that do this sort of thing. Now this Charlie's the same thing as that fool. Charles is Charlie, you see. Charlemagne, you see. Big Charlie, as it's called. Is this Harlequin fool figure. And as you said, of Charles I, he was a dear Charles, he knew the arts, he knew the sciences, he indulged in alchemy. He did everything except rule properly. You see, he is the perfect Charlie. So even colloquially we say, oh, he's a real Charlie, don't we? And people don't realise why they're saying he's a perfect Charlie. But it's a reference to Harlequin, this fool. And then he comes back again, this guy, you see. Same idea is represented after the big power man has hammered everybody and made them realise there's a worse thing than a king, you know. Apart from a silly king that does nothing, there's a very terrible strong man that does everything. You see, so we put another man who's just in between. And royalty's then safe until the next child is needed. And it's approaching. Anyhow, between now and the next scheduled meeting, if you want to do a very, very good exercise to prove these things to yourself, don't attempt to control yourself in any way differently from the way you have done before. Don't make any special efforts other than this. Watch in your mind and see if you can recognize the sentences that you hear that you would usually call yourself thinking. See if you can recognize who said that. Don't do anything else. Just recognize. Make no attempt to change anything, no attempt to hide a bad idea if one comes up. Look at it and maybe say, oh, that was Uncle Bill, and that was Aunt Tabitha, and so on. Whatever it was. And don't make any moral statement, that is good, that is bad. Only think that is so-and-so speaking. And stop saying to yourself, I am thinking. Merely say, there is so-and-so being said. Never say, I. Of any process, like I think, or I do, or I feel, that you mustn't do, because the eye doesn't do any such thing. The eye just watches, and the consciousness itself, the watching, changes the event. If you watch a little kid, he's playing, and he doesn't know, and you come in the room quietly and watch him, just watch what he does. Suddenly, you'll see the child become aware that he's watched. And at that moment, the quality of his play changes. He can't play now spontaneously. And he'll start becoming more graceful, more beautiful. You see? Because he's got to be his best. And exactly the same thing goes on inside the mind. If you focus the consciousness on an idea, and it's a bad one, it starts going, You see? And making it so beautiful. Because it doesn't like being looked at. Because all consciousness is a spontaneous criticism. It's a statement of what is. And it's a tremendously powerful exercise.